If I reflect back on the schedule for the insurance conference several years ago, 3 or 4 years ago, I think we had as many as 4 medical malpractice companies participate in the conference. There's only one publicly traded medical malpractice remaining, Pro Assurance, and they participated in the conference as long as I've been a part of it. Moreover, if you look at all of the companies that participated in the conference last year, Pro Assurance was the best performing stock of them all. It's my pleasure to have them here and welcome them back. We have Frank O'Neill, who's the Senior Vice President and Chief Communications Officer, Howard Freeman, who's Senior Vice President and Chief Underwriting Officer, and Stan Starnes, who's President and CEO. So with that, let me turn it over to Stan.
Thank you, Greg. Good morning. Thank you for having us again this year. I look forward to sharing with you a few thoughts about Pro Assurance. We have a book of slides in the back, although I won't be using the slides during the presentation, but it'll show you all the data and information to which we refer for the next few minutes. As Greg mentioned today, Pro Assurance is the only pure-play, publicly traded medical professional liability company in the United States. We're the only one left, I think, for several reasons: our size, the skill at execution, our geographic breadth, the reach of our products. But also it's important to note that we differentiate ourselves through the value that we offer for our insureds and for our investors. From the standpoint of our insureds, we create customers for life. From the standpoint of our investors, we try to create customers for life as we execute on our business. We enjoy a market capitalization of about $2.7 billion, shareholders' equity of $2 billion, total assets right around $5 billion. We pay an annualized dividend yield, 25 cents a share a quarter, 1.1% yield. We're rated A by Fitch and by AM Best. We have about 71,500 policyholders around the United States. 81.3% of our premiums come from physicians and dentists. They represent about 76% of our policyholders. Our product is distributed about 64% through agents and about 35% direct in Alabama and Florida, and our podiatric book is a direct book of business. As I said, we stretched across the United States. Our podiatric product is offered in almost every state. Our traditional MD-DO product is offered as far west as Nevada and through a broad swath of the middle part of the United States. In this business, the medical professional liability business, if you're in 30 states, you're in 30 different businesses. And you have to accommodate yourself to the reality of those 30 different businesses. Alabama and Florida are contiguous states, but they might as well be on different planets in terms of the difference in conducting this business in Alabama and conducting this business in Florida. We think local presence is very, very important. We do not try to execute our business from one spot on one coast or the other, or one spot from the middle of the country. We have offices spread across the United States in those regions where we have significant premiums, and we work very hard to stay in touch with the local nuances of each state in which we do business. We think that is very, very important, and that failure to do that has been one of the things that has produced the demise of these companies in the past. Since 2001, we have enjoyed a period throughout this industry, and even though we're the only publicly pure-play MPL, there are plenty of MPL carriers. There's at least one estate and sometimes two or three estate. Nobody has much over 8% of the market. It's a very fragmented market, and again, it's on a state-by-state basis. There are no large commercial carriers that are engaged in the very retail level of this business, and we do not write any catastrophic exposures. One of the things of which we are the proudest as Pro Assurance is that every year we've been public, which happened in 1991, and every ensuing year we have grown the book value of the company. We think book value is the metric which best reflects the true intrinsic worth of an organization such as ours, and we look at the book value with respect to every decision we make, and make every decision through the lens of book value. Our book value in 1991 was $3.67 a share, and as I've said, we've grown that book value every year since 1991, and at the end of 2011, the book value was $70.84 a share. That's a 16% compound and average annual growth rate, a cumulative growth rate of 1,832%. And the share price, not surprisingly, has generally followed the book value. We came at the end of 1991, the share was traded at $5.23, and recently it closed at 89 and change. The share price has grown on average compound growth rate of 15% and over 1,600% during that period. We take a lot of risk on the liability side of the balance sheet in terms of the policies that we issue. So we don't take much risk on the asset side of our balance sheet. We have a $4.1 billion investment portfolio. 90% of it is fixed income. Less than 10% is in equity and equity-like substitutes. We remain very worried about the impact of inflation, and therefore we hold the duration of our portfolio in. It averages right now today about 3.9 years, so that we think we're well positioned in not if, but when inflation rears its head. It's a high-quality investment portfolio. 96% of its investment grade, the weighted average, is AA-. As I mentioned, we currently pay a dividend of a dollar a year. We've repurchased $315 million worth of our shares since 2005. And we typically purchase shares at or around book value because, again, we look at everything through the lens of book value. Let me talk to you a bit about the business of ProAssurance and what we think differentiates us from others. And I will frankly tell you that that is our greatest challenge as an organization, is to keep our product from becoming a commodity, because we are not the lowest priced product in the marketplace. We think our product is very different from other products that are offered, and we think we can point to you and give you concrete reasons that that is so. And let me just give you a couple of examples of that. In the typical insurance relationship, the customer gives us a premium and we give the customer a piece of paper. There's not much difference in those pieces of paper. They all have printed words on them and they all say a lot of the same sorts of things. The difference comes, particularly in our line of business, when there is a claim. And bear in mind, unlike most other insurance companies, our claims take the form of lawsuits. They take the form of lawsuits against our insurers, lawsuits which have a real impact on our insurer. You know, a physician, more than anybody else in our society, is what she does. And if you sue her and you say to her that you killed or injured your patient, you strike at the very core of who she is. You strike at the very core not only of her professional life, but her personal life, because it's about a lot more than business. It's what she does. And so at that point in time, our product becomes very different from the products of others in our willingness to defend the physician if she has not done anything wrong, if she has not caused injury or death to the patient. Our willingness to say to the physician, this is not an economic matter for you, and it's too important for us to treat it as an economic matter to us. And therefore, since 1977, we have spent many more dollars defending physicians than we would have spent had we simply settled the claim. But our view of the world is that if you settle a claim just to close a file, just for economic expediency, you have diminished the physician and you have failed the physician. Because, you know, when we settle a case, and let me tell you quickly that we settle cases if those cases involve a breach of the standard of care which caused injury or damage to the patient. Those cases, the law says, are cases of liability, and we believe those cases should be resolved and resolved quickly and resolved on the basis the law requires. But if the case does not involve a breach of the standard of care and the insurance company settles it just for reasons of economic expediency, meaning they can settle it for X, and it would cost 3X to defend it. So they settle it, and they close the file. And the lawyer closes his file. The physician never closes that file. That file will be open the rest of her life. She will spend the rest of her life reliving that file every time she fills out an application for staff privileges, every time she fills out an application for professional liability insurance. That file continues to live. And she will have to disclose the fact that it was settled. You know, as people in Alabama say, old sayings get to be old sayings because they're true. And actions speak louder than words. And the insurance company can say, well, we're settling it just because that's the easy way to put it behind us. But the average person would say that you don't pay money unless you owe it. And therefore, to settle a file when the physician doesn't owe it does diminish the physician professionally and personally. We understand that. We get that. And that's why our product is different than the products that others offer, because we think the case in that circumstance should not be settled just for the economic expediency of the insurance company. And all of that philosophy is embodied in those two words that you see whenever you see the name ProAssurance, the two words being treated fairly. It's an awkward sort of combination of words when you first look at them, treated fairly, standing alone. And it's intentionally awkward because we want people to stop and think about what they mean. And it's not the typical corporate bromide. Treated fairly does not mean the customer's always right, because that wouldn't be fair. It also wouldn't be true. But treated fairly means that with respect to each of our constituency groups, our insureds, our shareholders, our employees, our agents, that we will endeavor to make certain that in every encounter, that person or that constituency comes away from us convicted of the notion that they have been treated fairly. It means that we will do whatever is necessary to make sure the customer understands our position and how we got there. And our view of the world is that rational people, once they agree on the facts, will almost always agree on the conclusion. And so treated fairly means a transparency and openness, so that we and our insureds are on the same page. Treated fairly means that our investors shouldn't sit around at night and worry about what's in that $4 billion investment portfolio. We post it on the web, down to the CUSIP number, so you can model it yourself to your heart's content. But you don't have to worry about it, because it's out there, transparent, to show you exactly what is in that investment. Our employees understand that treated fairly means to them that the company with which they are working is engaged in a significant, important enterprise that will bring worth and meaning to their life. They give a day of their life to the company, and it's important that it have worth and meaning. And treated fairly means that we acknowledge that and we recognize that. We believe that an important part of the operation of an insurance company such as ours is the individual evaluation of risk. And we do that through our underwriting department with rates set by our actuarial department. And we look at that one risk at a time. We're not in the world of large numbers. You know, a personal automobile, like Jim Gover spoke to yesterday for Infinity, they deal with lots of numbers, lots of different numbers. We deal with small numbers. And we underwrite those risks one risk at a time. And we try to price the risk appropriately. We are not a top-line company. You can have all the top line you want in this world, but it'll be a disaster for you. And that is particularly true with the long-tail business, such as medical professional liability, because, you see, we take your premium today, we give you the piece of paper, and it may be 4, 5, 6 years before that lawsuit, the claim, is resolved. So the long-tail nature of what we do means that it's very difficult for us, that with the small numbers, to bring the sorts of precision that a company dealing with large numbers can do. So we have to price our product years before we know what that product is going to cost us. And it's important that we price it right. It's important for our shareholders. It's important for the insured, because the insured gives us that premium years later, we'll be called upon, and the insured has to know that we'll be financially sound and in a position to deliver on the promise that we've made. And the only way to do that is by pricing the risk appropriately. And it's in the insured's interest as much as it is of the shareholder's interest that we price our risk appropriately. And we do that through very stringent, rigorous underwriting standards so that we understand the risk and that we price the risk appropriately. All of this, the claims philosophy that I've described to you, the underwriting rigor that I've described to you, very robust risk management programs across the company that enhance patient safety and therefore improve outcomes. All of these things in combination have produced, I think, a company that's offering a product that nobody else is offering. And that is borne out, and you'll see in the slides when you take a look at them in the numbers. Looking at the combined ratio for this industry, for the 5-year average, ProAssurance is at 73.5. Remember, lower is better. The industry average is 83.3, almost a 10-point difference in the combined ratio of ProAssurance and the rest of the industry. If you look at it over the last 10 years, ProAssurance is at 94.2 and the industry average is 106.3. And if you look at it for all years, we're at 93.6 and the industry is 109.7. And bear in mind, even though we've been in this benign period of profitability brought on by fairly predictable severity and low frequency, if you look at the last 30 years, we're the most volatile segment of the insurance industry. That's why every one of them left that was in from a commercial standpoint from time to time. We reserve our risk appropriately. We reserve our risk consistently. In recent years, we've been able to witness a significant amount of favorable development in our reserves. In 2011, that number was $326 million. Our net reserve per open medical professional liability claim today is $221,000 per claim. So we continue to be what we think is appropriately reserved, given the volatile industry in which we operate. I wanted to save a few minutes for questions. Let me just mention a couple of other things about the importance of the product we're offering to our insured. Today, in 26 states, the disposition of medical professional liability actions is published on the Internet for all the world to see. So when a patient is referred to, say, Dr. Smith for an orthopedic problem, and the patient goes online to look at Dr. Smith and sees that Dr. Smith has settled 3 claims, what does the patient do? Looks for Dr. Jones is what the patient does. Even though Dr. Smith may have done nothing wrong in those 3 cases, even though they were settled simply because some insurance policy hadn't priced its product to take the expense and the risk of a full trial, even though that'll remain with Dr. Smith the rest of his life, those claims are there, and none of that explanation is given, and nobody's going to take time to listen to the explanation. So that's why we think it's very important that the product we sell be emphasized in terms of the distinction and the differences it makes to other people. People ask me in our one-on-one meetings and elsewhere, what are the growth potentials for ProAssurance? And we're not in the business of predicting the future. But what we can say is this. The space in which we primarily operate is the healthcare environment. And the healthcare environment in the United States is going to change greatly. And the reason it's going to change greatly is the course we're on is simply unsustainable. We can deliver as a society more healthcare than we can afford. And this all-you-can-eat menu of healthcare benefits that every one of us has and every one of us takes full advantage of simply is going to become too expensive and not sustainable. And we have to add some market mechanisms back into the healthcare world. Now, we think this is going to present great opportunities for ProAssurance because of our geographic breadth and because of our size. We anticipate that in the world to come, more and more physicians will migrate into hospitals or large groups. It's happening already. The New York Times reported last year that already 50% of physicians in this country are employed by hospitals or hospital-affiliated organizations. That's going to create a sea change in terms of our business, because insuring a physician who's an employee of a hospital is very different than insuring an independent physician. Oftentimes, you're going to have to be of the size to insure the hospital in order to insure the physician. We've insured hospitals since 1985. We insure hospitals today. We anticipate that will become a significant part of our business going forward. Although I'm quick to say, we think that the solo practitioner and the small group physicians will remain. There'll just be fewer of them, and we will continue to be the mainstay for those physicians in terms of their medical professional liability product. Even in circumstances where the physicians are not employed by the hospital, we think there'll be closer relationships between the physicians on staff and the hospitals on whose staff they serve. And we think there'll be opportunities for us in that arrangement. And we've already seen that through our Certitude program. Certitude is a program that's a product of the arrangement between ProAssurance and Ascension Healthcare. Ascension Healthcare is the third largest healthcare provider in the United States, the largest healthcare system in the United States. And Certitude is a product that is offered solely to physicians who are on the staff of Ascension hospitals around the country. We have put the product in place in Michigan, and it's being rolled out in Florida even as we speak. And as I say, it's not a waterfall event, but it does create a creek which will become a bigger stream, which we hope in the fullness of time will become a river. And it actually provides a mechanism for a closer insurance arrangement between Ascension and its staff physicians. We were very proud when Ascension came to us to underwrite the program. We hold the pen. We underwrite each risk like we do the risk today. We price the product. But we think that sort of relationship is typical of the kinds of things one is going to have to be able to do in the future in order to take advantage of the healthcare world that's coming. All these physicians that are being employed by hospitals are being migrated into the hospital captives, and we think that will give us opportunities in the future. Insuring a physician is not like insuring a nurse. They are higher touch. They've got much more of a personal, reputational, and credentialing stake at issue than what is typically the case for a hospital captive. There are a lot of work, as we said. We think that'll give us opportunities to partner with captives in performing that work from both a claims and a risk management standpoint. We have a hospital program now called ProControl, which attempts to take advantage of the very different expectations between physicians and hospitals with respect to claims. Physicians, as a general rule, do not want their claim settled if they didn't do anything wrong, because they pay a high price for that settlement, and not in dollar terms, but in terms of impact on their credentials, their credentialing, and all the other things they talked about. Hospitals typically want the matter resolved. ProControl puts the hospital in charge of the first part of the limits of the policy to take steps the hospital deems important to take with respect to that claim. Just for example, we could write a $1 million policy under ProControl. The hospital would have say-so over the disposition of the first $250,000. The disposition of the next $250,000 would be a joint decision, and the disposition of anything over $500,000 would be up to us. We can structure that and have structured it with different hospitals in a variety of ways. But again, that's the type of product that we think in the future is going to be very, very careful. ProAssurance does things consistently. We reserve consistently. We underwrite consistently. And we've grown from a very, very small company with $5 million worth of borrowed capital in Alabama in 1977 to this organization that today has over $2 billion in stockholder equity. We're well poised for the future. We have, through our capital, the capacity to write a good bit more business, but we'll only write it when we can get the appropriate pricing for that. People ask about tort reform all the time. as I said at the beginning, if you're in this business in 40 states, you're in 40 different businesses, and tort reform is basically a state-by-state event. None has been passed in Washington. We don't anticipate any being passed in Washington. That battle will continue to be fought out on a state-by-state basis. In recent years, the last two or three, the judicial decisions have generally been unfavorable toward tort reform, with a couple of notable exceptions. The biggest pending issue today is the Florida tort reform legislation, which is now pending before the Supreme Court of Florida. But again, that will continue to be a state-by-state issue. We think the future at ProAssurance is very bright. We think that we will not become a commodity because we think what we are offering is very, very different. Now, everybody's going to tell you they're offering what we're offering, but if you look at the numbers, you see a big difference. And the fact we're offering something different, we think, is borne out by the fact that our retention of new business hovers around 89% or 90%, and incidentally, that's a pure number. We take into account all expiring premium, even though the person that paid that premium may have died or moved or become disabled. You can game that number a little bit if it's only premium available for renewal, but it's a pure number with us. 89-90% retention rate. People understand that our product is different, and they're willing to pay a fair value for that product, knowing that we're offering them something that really nobody else can offer and deliver as we can. And with that, I'll be delighted in the last few minutes we have to take whatever questions you may have.
If I understand correctly, you're the last publicly traded MedMal company, and more to the point, you seem to have a unique underwriting approach. Do you have a monopoly or near monopoly of underwriting teams that use your approach, or do underwriting teams tend to migrate, or is there a tendency for underwriting teams to migrate from one company to another? And the real gist of my question, if some multi-line decide they wanted to enter the MedMal business, you know, in competition with you, could they do so easily, or do you have a wide moat around you?
Well, there are lots of people that enter it all the time, so I don't think you'll have any trouble. From a standpoint of there are no real barriers, if you understand that it's a state-by-state business, you can't enter it on a local level, if you understand that it's a high-touch business, if you understand that handling a claim in Alabama is very, very different than handling one, say, in West Virginia, if you understand that handling a claim in Wisconsin is very, very different from handling a claim in Florida. Our underwriting teams are very stable. I mean, as I look around the organization, they've been there for decades for the most part. There's not a lot of movement back and forth between the companies. Bear in mind that while we have all of these companies, and there are lots of them, nobody's got more than about 8% of the market. Most of them are situated in one state or two states. There are a handful of players that sort of span the breadth of the United States. But most of the people are one in two state mutuals, for example, and even some of the bigger ones are mutuals. But we don't see a lot of movement of underwriters between the companies. Every company probably is a little bit different in the underwriting. Every company is, for the most part today, is a product of the 70s and 80s where you couldn't buy this insurance in the commercial markets, and that's why all these companies were formed. That's why we were formed. And in the early days, the company was simply an order taker. The physicians didn't have anywhere else to go. Today, they have lots of choices. That probably is one barrier to entry, is that just there's so many of them now, there's not a whole lot of people that want to get into it. But the difference is that every claim's a lawsuit, and that lawsuit's going to take years to resolve, and it has to be resolved on the basis of very special laws that deal with medical malpractice cases. And you have to be willing to take the risk of a trial. In those states that permit it, we will not settle a case without the consent of the insured, and we won't game him into settling the case. That is, try to scare him by having to come spend a week at the courthouse or 10 days, et cetera, because if he wants a trial, we certainly intend to give him that trial, and we'll hire the best lawyers available to give him that. We don't put constraints on our lawyers in terms of what they can do. We expect them to do everything that's needed to be done to successfully defend the doctor and secure her exoneration and vindication. But we don't have a monopoly on anything. The only thing that I like to say we've got a monopoly on is a commitment that exceeds that to the physicians of anybody else performing this business. But others would probably tell you they've got an equal commitment. We execute on that commitment, and we're in a marketplace that's robust, and people have choices to make. Yes, sir. The issue is, has tort reform had any significant effect on our business? To answer that question, you have to go state by state, because it's a state by state business. Across the United States in the last number of years, we've seen frequency, that is, lawsuits filed against physicians, drop. Some people would say, well, that's because of tort reform. But it's dropped in states that hadn't had meaningful tort reform. There are a lot of debates about what's caused frequency to go down, and you'll get as many different opinions as there are people in the discussion. Tort reform in some states probably has had a favorable impact, but clearly the decline in frequency is not all due to tort reform. Passage of tort reform is just the first step, and bear in mind, just because you call something tort reform doesn't mean it's going to be tort reform. Like that fellow in Alabama says, you can call a pig a beagle, but he's not going to hunt rabbits. Tort reform that's really meaningful tort reform that's passed is good for physicians, and therefore it's good for us. It's good for society because it ensures access to care. It assures that the patient's going to have a doctor to go to. But just because it's passed by the legislature does not mean that you're going to see benefits from it, because it's going to be challenged over and over again in court. And you've got to wait and see what the highest court in the state does with it before you can really give it and see that its impact. We think tort reform is important, but it's important because of our physicians. And they're entitled to the tort reform. And they're, you know, and I could go on for a long time about this, I won't. But lots of physicians feel like when they walk in the examining room, there are four people in the room: the patient, the nurse, the doctor, and the plaintiff's lawyer. And that doctor can be second-guessed for virtually anything she does, because she's got to make a decision. The lawyer gets to step back and wait and see what happens. And let me tell you, we're the greatest second guessers in the world. They don't ask us in advance how to do it, because we're no better at that than you are, probably not as good. But tort reform, in my mind, means that the system, that society, will treat physicians with dignity and respect and give due regard to the fact that the physician is dealing with a condition that's not of his making, and that no people react exactly the same way to the same medicine or the same condition. And the patient doesn't walk in holding a cardboard sign saying, I've got X. The physician has to figure it out, and sometimes X can present 20 different ways. We as a society have to recognize the difficulty with which we put physicians when we're not going to treat them with proper regard in the judicial process. And I think society agrees with that. Yes, sir.
Yes, I'd love to have you on my side if I have one of those problems. I'm just looking at the historical thing, and you had a period in the late 90s where I guess earnings were flat. Now, last year or two, you've had a big jump in earnings. Perhaps you could give us some sense of the context in which that happened, so we'll understand your business a little better.
Yeah. Remember, I said that if you look at the totality of this line of business since about 1975, it's the most volatile line in the insurance world. And that volatility was well reflected in that period in the late 90s, early 2000s you're talking about. when severity really ramped up, and it ramped up very quickly, and it had a very, very deleterious impact on everybody writing this business.
What do you mean by severity?
Severity would be, just to put it in layman's terms where I could understand, how much is a case worth? You know, if you have a broken wrist, is the jury going to give $100 for that broken wrist or $100,000 for that broken wrist? And that's the severity. Now, the actuaries have got a much more precise, sophisticated definition of it, but just among us, that works. The $100,000 for the broken wrist. And the broken wrist all of a sudden was worth a lot more than the $100 or $100,000, and severity just went very high. And remember now, we write the policy today, we collect the premium today, we give you the piece of paper today, but what that piece of paper is going to cost us is not going to be determined by what severity is today. It's going to be determined what severity is in 4 or 5 years. So in 1999, we were talking about premiums been collected in, 94, 95, that period of time, and severity just hit high levels and continued. And that had its impact on us and everybody else. And that's why we are so very conservative with our reserves, because we know that we've got to be there for what happens in the future.
Recently?
Recently, severity always goes up. It's never gone down in history. But it's the last number of years, it's been going up at a predictable, moderate rate of about 4% a year, roughly. Is that fair? 4% a year. And that's manageable. It's when it gets above that that it's not.
Thank you.
Yes, sir. Last question.
Well, I'll take the last question in two parts. First, very little commentary on the M&A side of the market, and that's an area where you've had a lot of activity in the past.
Yeah.
And secondly, from an insurance regulatory perspective, I think I saw something recently about California becoming a little bit more proactive on the insurance regulatory side of things, perhaps mandating a rate rollback. Perhaps you can provide us a perspective on those two areas, you know, from a national perspective.
Yeah. First of all, on the regulatory perspective, I've read the same thing. We don't write our traditional MD DO book in California on a large basis. We have some limited risk out there, but I've read the same things you have, that the MPL carriers have been undergoing a rate review through the commissioner out there, and there have been some rate decreases mandated or agreed to, and I don't think they've finished that process, and we'll just have to stay. But like everything else, the regulatory environment is essentially a state environment, and therefore it's a state-by-state thing, and you have different regulatory philosophies, different regulatory mandates coming out of each state, and you just have to consider it on a state-by-state basis. We have a compliance department that works very closely with all the state regulators in the states in which we do business, and we obviously accommodate ourselves to what those regulators want and expect from us. On the M&A, Greg is right. We're the product now of about 20 acquisitions, transactions, some as small as $15 million or so, some as large as $300 million. We continue and intend to continue to be active in the merger and acquisition area. We have lots of experience integrating businesses, and that's not easy to do. It's not easy to do because of the technology. It's not easy to do because of accounting. It's not easy to do because of the different aspects of different businesses. But the biggest reason it's not easy to do is because it involves lots of human beings. That's what makes integration so hard. But we think we're as good at it as one can be. You'll never reduce the threshold of risk to zero because it always involves different human beings. M&A is episodic and it's opportunistic. And in this field, you don't do hostile sorts of transactions. So you have to have two people willing to walk down the aisle together. Sometimes that's driven by financial difficulties of one party. Sometimes it's driven by one's perception of what the future looks like and the need to be bigger to play in that future that's coming. Sometimes it's driven just by strategic incentives. But the thing to remember is that you can't plan them. You can't make them happen. You have to be there and available. You have to have the capital to make it happen when you want it to happen. You have to be able to to have the flexibility to make that happen. And I think we'll see a good bit of it in the next 5 years. But again, you can't predict it, and you can't put it on a chart and say this is what we're going to do and when we're going to do it.
Fair enough.
Thanks, Greg. Thanks, everyone. Appreciate you coming.